So humans, first of all, are very bad at identifying misinformation. We showed people a true piece of information and a false piece of information. We didn't tell them which is which. And we asked them, can you identify what's misinformation? And we tell you that, you know, one of this is misinformation. If, since these are one out of two options, random guessing would be 50% accurate, right? Humans were only 66%, or two out of three times they were correct, one out of three times they were bad. So not great, right? And that's when we explicitly told them that one is misinformation, right? So if they would come across it casually on social media or on their WhatsApp forward, then they are even less likely to pay attention to it.
So hello and welcome everyone to whoever's listening to this particular podcast. Today I have with me Dr. Srijan Kumar. He's an assistant professor at Georgia Tech University with research interests in combating misinformation and harmful content on online platforms, building robust AI models that are prone to adversarial attacks, and behavior modeling for more accurate recommender systems. Before joining Georgia Tech, he was a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford University and completed his PhD in computer science from University of Maryland. He has received multiple awards for his research work, including Forbes 30 Under 30, and being named as Kavli Fellow by National Academy of Sciences. So, Dr. Kumar, it's nice to have you on the podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thanks for inviting.
So, can you tell us a bit about your interest in AI? What was your background before you got started into AI? And what was the most exciting thing that you found about AI?
Sure. So, I got into AI back in my undergrad days. So I took this very interesting course when I was an undergrad at Indian Institute of Technology, or IIT Kharagpur, back in India. I took this course on data mining and social network analysis, and I just found it to be super interesting. That was pretty much my first introduction to what one could call big data analysis, which is a precursor to what any sort of AI machine learning that you need to do because data mining and big data analysis helps you gather all the data and format all the data and mine insights and knowledge from the data that's out there to be then used to build machine learning, AI, and various other types of models on it. So I got super interested. I worked on a research problem as an undergrad with a couple of my friends as part of a course, and then we published it as well with the PhD student who was leading this research and a couple of professors at IIT Kharagpur. That's how I got started. Then I came to US to do my master's and PhD at the University of Maryland College Park, where I was fortunate to be advised by Professor V.S. Subramanian and had collaborations with various other faculty at CMU and Stanford and other places, where I got to learn the fundamentals of graph-based machine learning, computer vision, natural language processing, and so on. Over time, I found my interest to be very highly in natural language processing when applied to societal tasks. And that's what I've been doing for the past decade or so.
Yeah. And when was the time, like, how did you figure out your particular interest in AI? So as in, which particular thing appealed you the most? Because there are multiple, I think, domains in AI itself, right? Like talking about vision, language, reinforcement, game theory, there are lots of things that where we can apply AI techniques. How did you figure out your interest in a specific domain?
Great question. I was asking that exact same question when I was trying to figure it out. And it was very naturally exploratory for me. I tried computer vision. I found it to be very difficult but you know, I've always been fascinated by language. I've always been fascinated by graphs and networks. So I guess that was also difficult, equally difficult, if not more, compared to computer vision. But since I was particularly interested in these things, I pushed myself to learn those more and better. And I learned, I guess the moral of the story there is try to find an intersection between what you inherently like and what you what is the new exciting thing that's happening?
Yeah. And to be honest, it's a fantastic time right now to be in language research, because it's something on the boom right now. So it's really great to be in language research, or I would say in general, natural language processing.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah, but I wanted to also learn more about, like, what kind of projects are you currently involved at GeoGetics as a professor? What are the projects that you focus on most right now?
Sure. So my research expertise and interests lie in developing these AI, machine learning, data science models to enhance the safety, equity, and well-being of users, communities, and platforms online. I direct the CLAWS Lab, which stands for Computational Lab for AI, Web, and Society. Here, me and my 15 students are passionate about developing these solutions that can combat online bad actors, dangerous content, which currently pose one of the biggest threats to public health, democracy, science, and the entire society. So we are developing graph neural networks, natural language processing, adversarial machine learning techniques to detect, predict, and mitigate these online harms that have real-world impact. And in doing so, we mine terabytes of data to find actionable insights. And we look at both the societal as well as the technological aspects. We blend the two together to develop these multidisciplinary solutions to combat these harms. So over the years, we have developed various different types of models, machine learning models, that have eventually been deployed at Flipkart, which is India's largest e-commerce platform. We have influenced Twitter's Birdwatch platform when it was in its very early stages. And we have a system that is now being deployed at Wikipedia to help moderators over there. So that's like the overview of what my group, my students, and I do. In terms of the specific current projects that we are working on, we are quite interested in using the generative AI technologies that are here for societal good. So some of the exciting projects that we have is how we can develop AI models, how we can use generative AI models to counter hate speech online or counter misinformation online, and how can we do that in a way that is effective and that is that can actually change minds, that can actually have societal impact. We are also working on projects where we're looking at robustness of various different AI models and its implications on security, on fairness, and various other desirable attributes. So there we are looking at robustness of recommender systems, robustness of multimodal and multilingual models, robustness of bad actor detection models, and so on. And we are also looking at how information flows across platforms and how we can predict and mitigate the spread of harmful content from one platform to the other, and also at the same time how we can create systems that can promote the spread of good content to let's say combat online harms. So these are some of the projects, some of the research projects that we are working on. And at the same time, we are also building tools, various different tools to empower end users to be more efficient and better. So for example, we are deploying a tool at Wikipedia, which I just talked about, which will aid Wikipedia moderators to be more efficient in how they identify bad actors on the Wikipedia platform. We are also creating tools that can help professional fact checkers and journalists identify misinformation and try to correct it online. And also we are building tools for ordinary users to be more efficient in detecting and correcting misinformation. So these are some of the projects, both on the research side and on the tool building side, that my students and I are working on.
Yeah, no, fantastic. I think there's a fantastic list of projects that you're working on. Maybe try to understand these things in much more detail. So let me ask you, as in, what do we mean by misinformation? So for someone who might just use social media just for fun, he or she might not know what exactly we talk about when we say misinformation that is being spread on online. So can you give some instances, like what are the real instances of misinformation? We know the whole like I think there is a whole study where people have done for the 2016 US election, right, which was swayed using these kind of misinformation that was on Twitter and other kind of platforms. So how, what are the things that we are looking for when we say misinformation spread online? What do they look like?
Sure. That's a very good question, Jay. So misinformation can take all sorts of shapes, forms, and it can come in various different languages. Misinformation primarily is content. So let me distinguish between misinformation and disinformation. So misinformation is verifiably incorrect information that is spreading online, right? So the key thing here is verifiable, which means it's not someone's opinion. There is some evidence from reputed organizations or entities or individuals that this information is wrong. And then there's disinformation. Disinformation is also verifiably inaccurate information, but it is spread specifically with intent to create harm. So misinformation, the first one, does not have that intention of doing harm. It can be done for fun. It can have downstream impacts of harm, but that's not necessarily the intention of the person who is creating the misinformation. Disinformation, on the other hand, is created by state actors, for example, nation state actors who are trying to harm others. So that's the distinction between misinformation and disinformation. We have shown, and various other research has also shown, that ordinary users are terrible at identifying whether something is true or not, because we inherently have this trust bias that if it comes from someone that we like, if it comes from someone that we know for a long time, it is most likely going to be true. That's the reason why misinformation spreads so virally. There's very popular research by my friend Surush Vasogi and his collaborators. They have shown that misinformation, false news, spreads faster, deeper, more broader than true information. Misinformation has this virality because it taps into the inherent, not just the factual brain, but the emotional side of the brain. And people are more likely to engage with it. People are more likely to spread it and forward it. And at the same time, as people are engaging with it, the recommender systems that are deployed on these platforms, they take these interaction signals as being high quality, as being positive signals of high quality information. And then the recommender systems also amplify it. Right, so it's a very complex phenomena, but ordinary users currently and unfortunately are not very well versed at identifying what's misinformation or not. When we do research projects where we have to deal with misinformation, we are never the arbiters of truth. We are not trained to do that. But there are people who are professionally trained to identify whether something is true or not. So we rely on their judgment. So these are professional fact checkers. These are journalists who have the professional training behind them to look into one specific claim and do a deep dive into that, into the facts and facts behind that claim. They spend hours doing this. And at the end of that process, they say to what degree that information, that claim, is true or not. And then they provide that evidence. So there are various different fact-checking organizations that we rely on. Primarily, when we are doing our research, we rely on fact checks created through this fact-checking consortium called the International Fact-Checking Network, which has a very extensive process of vetting professional fact-checking and journalistic organizations who then put out fact checks. So we take the fact checks that have been created by these professionals, and we use that as our as we would technically call it, ground truth for identifying what's true and what's not.
Right. And let me branch off this conversation, because one of the key things that you mentioned that also brings me, like, we'll put a bookmark, like I'll come to the specifics of this particular conversation too. One thing that you mentioned is like misinformation typically comes from like reputable sources, right? So it's like specific, like we trust these sources to have our information input, but it could be misinformed. So like I'm learning information in a confident manner, but I'm learning the wrong information. And this brings me to something like I have been like, this was something I was discussing with my colleague at my lab. And when the ChatGPT came, a lot of people just switched onto that particular mode because yes, when you type in a question, the answer format looks really appealing. So if I'm searching, like typically I would be searching for things that I'm either very good at or maybe like I'm very bad at, right? Like if I'm learning something like a totally new topic. So one of the key things that he mentioned to me was like when he or she's typing on these particular tools, the information is kind of, I would say, convincing enough. Like, I don't know how to put it the right technical word, but when I tried this particular tool and for the things that I know, what are the outputs looking like and what should be the correct information? Like normally on Google, we can verify that saying that, oh, if it's a highly cited paper, I know this is true because this has been published by the leading researcher in this topic. But versus it's completely wrong with like something like ChatGPT. Do you think in this kind of works where you're trying to combat misinformation, tools like ChatGPT, can these tools make things worse when you're trying to limit misinformation? Or like, let me know what your comments are in broadly speaking. What do these tools, like, do they contribute to misinformation or it's a completely different genre of information search?
Thanks for the question, Jay. Very, very interesting question. Let me answer that in two parts. So misinformation is often, so humans, first of all, are very bad at identifying misinformation from true information. So we did one of the first works several years ago based on misinformation on Wikipedia. So this was not social media misinformation, but we did a fun experiment. So we showed on Mechanical Turk, we showed people a true piece of information and a false piece of information. We didn't tell them which is which. And we asked them, can you identify what's misinformation? And we tell you that, you know, one of this is misinformation. And if, since these are one out of two options, random guessing would be 50% accurate, right? Humans were only 66%, or two out of three times they were correct, one out of three times they were bad. So not great, right? And that's when we explicitly told them that one is misinformation, right? So if they would come across it casually on social media or on their WhatsApp forward, then they are even less likely to pay attention to it. But then the interesting part is we looked at what mistakes people were making. Why were they thinking that something was true, or why were they thinking that something true was false? And what we found was that when content was written in a nice format, when it seemed correct, when it seemed like its formatting is correct, when it seemed quote unquote authoritative, when it had, I mean, this is Wikipedia. So when it had the sections, when it had images and so on, when it looked like visually, when it had hyperlinks and so on, people trusted it, right? Because they just trust the way things are written. That is exactly the thing that these tools, these AI tools, are really good at generating content that looks correct, even if the factual information within the generated content might not be correct, right? That's why the believability of ChatGPT-based information or any generative AI-based information that's generated is very tricky and very challenging to deal with, because of how nice the generated content flows and how believable it is. That's one of the issues, believability. But even bigger than that, the issue, one of the biggest issues why these generative AI models have created for us now, is they can be run at they can be run to generate incorrect content not just misinformation, but any sort of incorrect content, including conspiracy theories and so on, at a super large scale. So you can generate many varieties of the same information. You can generate this misinformation in various different languages. You can do it at a super high speed. So it doesn't take you now 10 hours to write a misinformation article. You know, you can do that in a very, very low, very high speed. And of course, it takes, it's very cost effective in a way. So the volume is the issue. And the third is that with these tools, it becomes very easy to hyper-personalize misinformative content. Right now, that's not happening in the sense that when a certain piece of misinformation is created, the same piece of misinformation is broadcasted to everyone through the channels that these misinformation spreaders have created over time. The same misinformation is spread. But now, with the power of AI, one can create very personalized misinformation. That's personalized. The same misinformative content is written in a way that will appeal to your religious belief, that will appeal to your various different types of interests that you have, and so on. So essentially, think of it as the combination of recommender systems and these large language models together being used to generate misinformation make it more believable. Based on these things, it will become much and much harder for the platforms to deal with misinformative content, which already is a big problem for them. And what I believe is going to happen is, I believe that right now we are at this juncture, at this crossroads, where if we don't do something now about this issue, we'll regret that for this decade or several years to come. And we and it's a really hard problem to solve. One of the reasons it's very hard to solve is because even before ChatGPT, it was very difficult to identify misinformation, right? Mm-hmm. Just because of how it's written and fact verification is very difficult. Even if individual platforms, individual APIs, individual companies are able to create these filters or layers on their APIs to prevent this prevent generation of false information, there are various different open source models, open source versions of these large language models that can be used to still generate mis and disinformation. That I feel is the biggest challenge. Disinformation even more than misinformation, because when we are dealing with nation state actors that are super, they have the resources, they have the talent to operate heavy machinery behind all of this, we can be certain that such type of AI generated content will start circulating pretty soon.
Yeah, no, I think what you said, like, this also innovates me in thinking, because I've never thought in that way, because I knew these kind of tools like ChatGPT, they can create information that is very convincing, but I didn't realize that you can actually personalize those convincingness of these answers also. Because, and that would be, I think, I'm not sure if that's already being done or not ChatGPT, but like other tools, but it's very exciting. So let me try to understand an intuition from tackling these problems. So since you work on these kind of, so let's take a two-step process. So you said about disinformation and misinformation. So let me try to understand, what is your intuition when you say you are trying to combat misinformation using AI tools? So let's say if there is one topic that is the buzzword right now, and you have multiple sources like CNN and lots of other news sources writing articles. Now, there could be misinformation, and these are reputed sources. So any kind of false information would fall under the category of misinformation. So what is the intuition? Can you pick some of your work where you would try to tackle these kind of spread of misinformation from these sources? And you can take any of your works that you can, but try to I'll let you explain the intuition behind this. Like, what is the intuition of these algorithms?
Sure. So there are various different types of algorithms that lie in the category of how you can use AI to help combat online harms. So I bucket them into two categories. One is detection of these online harms, and the second is mitigation. So let's start with detection. So when I joined Georgia Tech, so that was in January 2020, and March 2020, everything went online because of the pandemic. And I was just getting settled in Atlanta, trying to find where good restaurants are, good coffee places are, and so on. And things, as you might recall, were very chaotic on the ground. You know, people were rushing to Costco to fill their trucks with toilet paper and sanitizers and so on. And while all of this chaos was going on in the physical world, a whole other storm was brewing in the online world. And that was the storm of online misinformation regarding COVID. And it was crazy. Like, there were so many different types of misinformation that was flowing around related to taking various different type of fake cures of COVID-19. So taking garlic, eating garlic and lemon and ginger would cure COVID. I got those on WhatsApp forwards. I saw those online as well. There were misinformation around that Bill Gates is behind COVID-19. Later during the cycle, we got more harmful misinformation that taking ivermectin and hydroxychloroquine can cure COVID-19. That led to people taking them. And unfortunately, many of them had to be rushed to emergency rooms because, you know, it's not safe to take it. Then there were various different types of online misinformation that vaccines cause various different types of COVID vaccine misinformation that they contain biochips and they are not safe, and so on and so forth, right? So various different, so as time evolved over, let's say, this 3-year period, various different types of online misinformation has spread. And as this online misinformation has spread, we have had to develop these NLP models to detect these this misinformation online. Now, as I explained before, we never say what is true and what is not. We rely on professional fact-check labels that are created. So we wait for that. We wait for those labels to come out. Let's say we are interested in studying COVID vaccine misinformation. So typically, the data that we use is from Twitter. And we collect data using COVID and vaccine keywords and various different types of variants of these keywords that we would have. So we wouldn't just use COVID, we'd use coronavirus, C19, COVID-19, and so on. So we would create a keyword set and we would start crawling data based on those. Then we'd use the fact check labels that have been provided by professional fact checkers to see which of these claims are true or not. So we would, if on the fact check it says that taking ivermectin, so that ivermectin does not cure COVID-19, then we would go and on Twitter and we would find tweets that mention the word ivermectin and vaccine and so on, and we'd get these tweets. Then we would follow this process. So far, we have done that manually, but of annotating content from that's misinformation from true information based solely on the fact check. So we'd label anywhere from 200 to 2000 data points. That takes time, as you can imagine, but that gives us this ground truth of online social media content that is now verifiably incorrect. Some of these are true and some of these are not. Essentially, tweets are labeled in these two categories. And then we create a classifier on top of that. So we'd use anything from Roberta or BERT embeddings to create these classifiers to anything more complex than that. And we would be able to use these models to detect misinformation. So far, we have developed various different types of these classifiers based on various different types of misinformation that has spread over the last 3 years. But as you can imagine, this is a very time-consuming process because we need to label a lot of data. So these days, we are exploring the use of few-shot learning techniques to identify to create these classifiers that are much faster than much faster to train, because they only would require, let's say, 10 data points to be labeled. So we are in the process of doing that, but that's one of the things that we use when we are solely looking at text. Then there comes the graph part, where we look at the social network, the retweet network, the content network, and we look at how the things are spreading and where it is spreading to, and we create graph neural network based models on top of those. So graph neural networks, for those in the those of you who are listening, who are not familiar with it, is this emerging area of machine learning where you create machine learning, deep learning based models that uses the graph or the network structure. So you can imagine a social network is a graph where you have each user representing a node in the graph, and edge is a follow-followee relationship between two users or two nodes. You can create a retweet graph where the edges would be who retweeted whom and so on. So you can create graphs out of pretty much everything. And these graphs are much more informative, because now you're not just looking at what is the content that is being spread, but who is spreading it, or who are the set of users who are spreading it, what are the patterns of the spread, and what are the timestamps of the spread. Prior research has shown that the spreading patterns of false information is very different from true information. So when we can incorporate all that information into our graph neural network model, we are able to create these better detectors of online misinformation. So over the years, we have created various different such models using graph and natural language processing. And we have used those to identify identify misinformation, and also we have open sourced many of these data sets, many of these classifiers and hand labels that we have created, so that other researchers and other entities that are interested in this can use this. So that's a long explanation of how we create these various different types of misinformation detectors.
Right. So I think, it's an interesting approach. So I think you are trying to create a classifier based on two sets of modalities. One is basically the information content of the tweet here in this case, like which is the post. So tweet itself and its activity. So like what kind of spreading network it has been referring to. And I'm curious. So like just a follow-up question is like, would you say there are some patterns that are specific to the spreading of these content that is highly discriminative of telling it is it like misinformation versus like a genuine information? I'm just curious, like, do we see these kind of correlations?
Right. Thanks. Yeah, that's an interesting question. A lot of research has gone behind it. It's also a part of my NSF career proposal that recently got awarded. So what we are, if you actually look at not just the spread, but look at the spread with intent or with sentiment, right? Yeah. So what we see, what we have shown is that when misinformative content is spread, there are other users in the social network who will reply to that misinformation and will express skepticism or will express doubt about it. Well, and that this happens not for long, like this wouldn't happen for all misinformative content that's spreading, but on average, it happens more for misinformative content than for true content that is spreading. And these create these, when this interaction is happening from other users of the social network, this creates this what we call as a signed social network, where you have a negative reaction, negative sentiment from another user to this piece of content, and these types of signals are very telling of whether something is true or not. This happens also for true information, but at a lower rate. So when you are looking at long term patterns, you are looking at long term data, you are able to identify these, you are able to mine this knowledge, you are able to identify what patterns emerge.
Yeah, and a curious comment on that one is like, I'm trying to relate it to some of the works that I have been doing. So one of the key things that when I like, typically what I work is on medical images, right? And normally when most of these algorithms are inspired from natural images, like the normal vision community, and then we try to apply these models. But one of the fantastic, or I would say interesting challenges of medical imaging community would be the information content is very different, right? So like normally if when we try to build a classifier or a detection model on natural images, we are trying to focus much more on abstract details. Like I would be okay like with your, let's say, one person's face versus the other person's face. But in medical images, it is very sensitive. As in, like, if I'm trying to detect a tumor, what are the chances that it is just picking up some noise on the periphery of brain and blah, blah, blah. Those kind of like very nitty-gritty details of the problem. My question relating to this one is like, let's say you build a classifier based on content, like the one that you say, like that is like a extended version of Roberta or something. What are the chances that it is fitting to the style of writing rather than the content of the writing? So as in like, it could be the case that whatever the ground truth, the fact-checking thing that you said, it labels them correctly, but the model is fitting to the style of writing rather than the content of writing. So it is just creating like a biased version of the classification where it just classifies like when on the inference stage, let's say it relates to a particular style of writing and it labels them that this is misinformation. Whereas it could be the case that it is genuine information, but written in a XYZ style or manner.
Right. Great question. So I'll answer that in two parts. One is when you label a lot of data online, let's say not the few shot setup, but the setup where you label 2000 data points, you see a lot of different varieties of false information being written in different styles and true information being written in different styles. And that's the sole purpose why we have to label 2000 tweets, let's say, that are pretty much spreading the same, like the claim is the same, right? It's ivermectin does not spread COVID-19. The reason we have to label so many data points is that we learn from various different styles and this various different ways in which the same misinformative content can be spread or written in different ways. So when we create these large data sets, you are more likely to be able to create the classifier to learn from the content rather than just from the style, right? So it's always the combination of the style and content, but think of it as averaging over a lot of different data points, you are focusing more on the content rather than on the style. Yeah. Now to the second part, this does not necessarily eliminate the role of style, right? So that means that style can still be a factor and you can write misinformative content in a way or in a different style that the classifier would think is correct. So this brings me to a lot of work that we are doing around robustness of AI models, where we are trying to understand how would different writing styles, how would different ways of expressing the same thing lead to classifiers being fooled. We are also creating a lot of benchmarks around this, so that before these models are being deployed or being released, they can be benchmarked against various different types of content. And you not just have the accuracy labels, but also robustness labels, robustness benchmarking being done before these models are released. So it's a very timely problem to be looking at because it's not solved yet. It's a very interesting research problem. And it's something that we are actively working on because we know that these issues exist in the models that are being trained, not just by us, but pretty much anything that's out there is very vulnerable to various different types of unintentional rewrites or unintentional ways in which something is being spread.
Yeah. And one of the key things that you mentioned, and I want to spend some time on that particular topic also, is like robustness. But before we go there, I wanted to also ask more about like one of the works that has featured is the Hawkeye for Twitter's birdwatch thing. So first question is like, I'm not sure like the one approach that you mentioned about like using content and graphs, is that one of the part of the birdwatch or is that something separate work that you are doing? Like, can you tell us a bit more? Like if it is the same, let me know. But if it is different, can you tell us bit more about, because I found it to be very interesting, because a lot of, I think there is a lot of chaos around Twitter, like being the place that kind of spreads the misinformation. And it's very cool for someone like you who has deployed a model or deployed a technique that is being run at the Twitter's platform. So can you tell us a bit about Hawkeye? And if it is the same that you described, let me know.
It's not the same. But I also want to clarify, we did not, or I was not involved in deploying or developing the BirdWatch system. Our work was was used as a reference point by the team at Twitter who developed the BirdWatch system. But I can certainly talk about it because it's a very innovative platform. We looked at Hawkeye. We created Hawkeye, which looked at the robustness of the BirdWatch system. So I'm happy to talk about that. Yeah. So as I was saying, in response to your previous question, that on Twitter and on other platforms, when misinformation is spreading, other users react to it and say that, you know, it may be wrong and it's incorrect and so on, right? And here's a fact check and so on. So that's already happening on social media. So we studied in a paper that we published now 3 years ago, we looked at how is misinformation spreading around COVID-19 on Twitter, and how is counter misinformation, how are misinformation corrections spreading on Twitter? And what we found was that while professional fact checkers and fact checking organizations are the ones who are creating the fact checks, they don't actually engage with people who are spreading misinformation. Ordinary users like you and me, we are Twitter users, or social media users broadly, ordinary users are the ones who are actually engaging and correcting misinformation online. So 96% of all counter misinformation messages are spread by ordinary users. This highlights the role that ordinary users have in keeping the social media platform a good and a safe place for everyone to be to use. BirdWatch is a system that formalizes that idea, which Twitter has deployed, where it enables communities to detect and flag misinformation. So anyone can go on the platform, go on the BirdWatch platform. They have now renamed it to Community Notes. So anyone can go and provide labels to fact checks, or rather label to tweets, saying I think this is misinformative and here is why, I think this is correct and here is why, and so on, right? So it creates a platform where ordinary users can explicitly label content as true or not true and various other labels. That is a very innovative idea, because various different research has shown that crowds have this power where on average they perform equally well as professionals when they are doing any sort of content labeling, and by using the power of the crowd or the wisdom of the crowds, you can do these jobs at a larger scale, right? So the Hawkeye work, what we did was we realized that not everyone in the crowd, not everyone in the community will have equal expertise and equal incentive to label correct things as correct and incorrect things as incorrect, right? There will be bad actors who will try to manipulate the system by labeling good things as bad and vice versa. So what we looked at was how robust, how reliable is the current system? And if not, what can be done? So it wouldn't be surprising that just a simple aggregate voting of how many truth versus how many false labels or content gets is not reliable to identify and can be easily manipulated, like very easily manipulated. So we proposed a sort of reputation system for labeling to say you should not only consider how many true and false labels a piece of content has received, but also what is the reputation of the user in giving these labels. how has the user previously given reliable labels or not. So we created an algorithm that learns these the reputation score of each labeler and uses that to aggregate in a better way and provide a better label for the birdwatch system. But the broad idea that the birdwatch and the broadly the idea that you can use and empower ordinary users or communities to detect and correct misinformation is something that I think is a great idea and is a great way to go forward, because ordinary users are the ones who are actually on the ground looking at information, and just by empowering them to do it at a larger scale, to do it effectively and correctly, and educating them to do it better, you can identify misinformation, even emerging misinformation, at a scale that was not possible before.
I see. That's interesting. So I think, yeah, the assumption over here is, as in a group of people labeling these tweets would kind of provide like a pseudo label for the birdwatch program. But let me ask you like a very corner case. I'm not sure if this is a corner case or not, but let's say there is a person with a post or a tweet that is being done. But let's say if there is a targeted labeling on these. So a lot of people, let's say 1,000 people decide that they just want to take this particular content down and they do a negative labeling or whatever, like labeling this as false information, even though it could have some genuine information. Would these kind of approaches, or like a better version of this approach, be able to detect that? Because these would be genuine users like you and me, who might have the label of like I forgot the name that you said, but like is like a reputed user, right? Like, or maybe like a genuine reputation. User. Mm-hmm. Yeah, rather than like someone like a bot or something. So how would this particular technique challenge this scenario?
It's a hard scenario to deal with, but hopefully, but if a lot of users who have very low reputation scores, because they have, you need to, let's say, build your reputation score over time, right? Mm-hmm. So if you are a user, if let's say 1,000 people are doing the downwards or upwards, and none of them or very few of them have participated on the birdwatch platform, let's say, or have given reliable, very few people have given reliable labels in the past, then you should be able to, then their reliability or reputation score would be low, right? So the weight that would be given to their labels would be very, very low. And that being said, none of these systems that rely on community labels they are prone to manipulation, right? That is an ongoing challenge that always comes when you are dealing with that's an ongoing challenge. Yeah. But that also highlights the need of why we cannot only and solely rely on community labels alone, why we need this ensemble where you have these machine learning classifiers that look at the content, the machine learning classifiers that look at the network propagation signals, as well as you can augment that with community labels to do the misinformation detection.
Yeah, and one of the good things that I find about this approach is like there is a human feedback which is being weighed very nicely, because it could be the case, like, because it relies on people in this case that label this information with notes that you said. So it could be the case that a person would have the knowledge. Let's say you are a Twitter user and somebody posts about combating a misinformation using AI, and you go ahead and make a note. Then I would at least have a better understanding of that model or a technique, because I know there are at least 10 or 15 people who are experts who have labeled this. So mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that is one of the good things, rather than just deploying a model that is trained on XYZ data set and who is doing these tasks.
Right. Yeah, we are super interested. I mean, beyond Birdwatch, right? Birdwatch is a very specific platform that's deployed on Twitter. But broadly, my group is very interested in the idea of using and empowering ordinary users to do not just detection, but also correction of misinformation effectively. So I think I am very positive on these community-based approaches.
And what do we mean by correction of misinformation? As in like taking steps to deleting that misinformation? Like what do we mean by correcting misinformation here?
Sure. Yeah, I can elaborate on that. So as I just said, that 96% of online countering of misinformation is being done by ordinary users, right? So that means if someone says something misinformative, someone else on the social network, either direct friend or friend of friend or someone in the network, is likely to correct that misinformation.
Oh, okay.
So that's called social correction, where someone else in the social network is correcting someone. And that leads to something called observational correction, where you're not only is the person who's spreading the misinformation being corrected, but anyone who's observing this interaction, so any of the followers of the original misinformation tweeter and the corrector, they are also observing that, you know, this was false and this is the fact check behind that. This has been shown to work very well. So a lot of social science research has gone behind it, where they've shown that this sort of correction of one user to the other works across topics, across partisan lines, across different time frames, and so on. So it's valued by users. It's trusted by users because it's not coming from an institution or from an organization that they might not trust. It's coming from someone in their individual social network that they might have a common friend with, for example, right? So there is a lot of value in people correcting other people when, of course, something is wrong. But not everyone does it, and not everyone does it correctly, as you can imagine. There's a lot of name calling that happens. There's a lot of abuse hurling and so on. In fact, our data shows that 2 out of 3 times, the correction messages are quite uncivil. They are, you know, you would not want to read them, and it can actually backfire. But 1 out of 3 times, the correction messages are actually, you know, are factual and polite and evidence and so on. So we came up with this idea a couple of years ago when we started to think about, can we use the advancements in natural language processing, specifically generative natural language processing, to create good counter misinformation messages. So the idea is that given a misinformation post, can you create a reply to it that corrects that misinformation by providing refutation, making it evidence, making it polite, and giving it factual information. So we worked on it for about a year, and we have a paper that's actually being presented a couple of weeks from now at the ACM Web conference or www, where we'll present the model that we have created. And this is pre GPT era, right? We have been working on this for about 1.5 years or so, but the idea is that we can use these generative AI models to create these counter replies. Now, you know, it remains an open question of how these tools can be used by ordinary users so that they can better counter misinformation online in an effective manner that is not only respectful, but can also change minds without backfiring. So that's one way where, you know, ordinary users, since they're already doing misinformation correction, right? Ordinary users are already doing it, but they're not doing it well. So there's a gap, there's a need to create tools that can enable them to do it correctly.
I see, interesting. So it would be more like if you have a piece of misinformation, that particular tool will help you create notes, or in this case, replies, or maybe an engagement that is maybe correcting the information, saying that, hey, this XYZ things that are being claimed in this particular content piece is wrong, and versus ABC is the correct version of those claims, or something similar to that.
In a way, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Interesting. And I do have one question on the adversarial part of this, but let me also jump to one of the questions that I had in mind, but I wanted to clear it out. We said about two tasks. So there is misinformation and disinformation. And disinformation is something where you have wrong information or pieces of information coming from non-reputable sources. Like, let's say someone like me, who is not that much reputable on Twitter, but it is trying to post something that has lesser fact-checking. Like, people might not be able to claim who am I. And in that case, how do we define...
Sorry, Jay. Can I correct that? So disinformation is coming with intent to harm. And it's typically coming from nation state actors. So it's not coming from you, for example. It's not coming from ordinary users, right? It's coming to manipulate people, right? Specifically with the aim of manipulating people. So the intent is to harm, and it's coming from, and the source, they might not, like, it might be on any website, right? The source doesn't matter. Same for misinformation. Misinformation is also false information, and it can come from any, it doesn't need to come from a reputed organization or reputed website. It can come from any, it can be hosted, for example, on any platform.
I see. So it would relate to something like that we have, like, in Twitter bots. Like, bots are created with the intent to harm. Is that correct? Would that relate to disinformation?
I don't want to name name something, but yeah, not necessarily Twitter bots, but state, like, certain country creating certain type of propaganda or disinformation that can interfere with certain other country's content.
I see. Okay. Then let me put this question in the other bucket. That, as in, like, I was more interested in the idea of, like, let's say bots, right? Because that was something I tried to dabble myself, like, just from curious perspective, nothing much more like a fine-grained research. But is it possible? Is it possible to detect these kind of fake bots on Twitters that are trying to, let's say, spread information? It could be either good or bad. Because if you see, these bots typically try to tweet or retweet or like certain kind of comments. They don't have really an agenda or like a common ground to being like personalities of a real person. Is it really possible to detect these kind of bots versus, let's say, someone like a static user like me? I'm not that much active on Twitter, but I'm just occasionally active. So even my activity could look as much as random as that particular bot. Is it possible to detect these kind of behaviors?
Indeed, it is. So bots are, so there's a lot of research that has gone behind identifying bots. There are several friends of mine who have spent decades studying how you can detect what are the behavioral characteristics of bots and how you can distinguish bots from ordinary users. And, you know, there are various very peculiar behavior characteristics that bots have. So when you look at, for example, the time when these bots are active and the behavior, the temporal patterns that they have, you would find that bots are active in various, first of all, they're super active. Most of the bots are super active, right? They're engaging a lot, they're tweeting a lot, they're retweeting a lot, and so on. That is one. They're active at weird hours, right? You would not expect someone who is located on East Coast being active every 20 minutes, for example, even throughout night, right? So you find these weird temporal patterns. You find these, you also find these weird clusters where you have these set of accounts that are retweeting each other and liking each other and following each other. So you get these clusters. So that's where the network analysis piece comes in as well. Mm-hmm. And you also find that ordinary users have this bursty behavior, right? Like, you log in, you do a bunch of activities, and then you become inactive or log out. Then you log in again after several hours, you have this bursty activity and you log. So these types of bursty behaviors are very typical of ordinary users, but you don't see those in typically on ordinary bots.
I see.
Now, of course, knowing all of this, you can create a bot that mimics a very human-like behavior. That's what makes it super difficult to identify bots and or any sort of these online harms, because this is always an arms race. So I'm not talking about bots, but in general, any misinformation detector that we create, right? Any sort of bad actor detection model that you create, anything that you do, and you publish a paper on it, and you create a classifier that says whether something is, let's say, misinformative or not, or bot or not, and so on. If you are smart enough, you can create another version of the same thing that is able to fool those detectors, right? So this becomes an arms race between the people who are creating these bots and the people who are trying to detect them, or people who are creating the misinformation, people who are trying to detect them. And it's a very real thing, right? It's the same thing happens in cybersecurity. There are always people who are trying to infiltrate your cybersecurity, your network, and there are always these always defenders against them. Right? Same malwares are always upgrading and improving over time, and so are the antivirus systems that are there. Right, so it's always an arms race, and so is the scenario in this disinformation, bad actor, bot scenario, online harm scenario as well. So these are very difficult to identify. Even more difficult to identify than bots are cyborgs, which are these combination of accounts where it's an account that's partially bot behavior and partially human behavior, right? So there's a human behind the account, but it's also operated as a bot. So it's a combination, and then it becomes super tricky because it is able to do the manipulation but also has the bursty behavior, for example, right? So this arms race is very real. And along those lines, we have been trying to study the adversarial nature of these detectors, right? Because you can try to understand that if you have a detector, let's say that's detecting a bad actor, and you know that the bad actor can evolve its behavior, can update its behavior to fool the model. Can we do it in a formal, can we study this in a formal manner?
Yeah.
That's something that we've been trying to look at under this umbrella of work that we have in my group, where we're looking at adversarial robustness of AI models. So for example, a couple of years ago, my group got a Facebook faculty award to look at the problem of how robust bad actor detection models are, or fraud detection models. So every big platform, Facebook, Snapchat, Twitter, Reddit, every platform that you can imagine has various different type of bad actor detection models in place. Many of these are similar to the type of models that I was describing earlier, that look at the behavior, the network, the linguistic attributes, and so on. So what we wanted to understand is, how robust are these detection models? How robust are these detection models to behavior changes that bad actors might make? So we created a framework that was able to do adversarial attacks on these bad actor detection systems. And we were able to show that many of these systems are actually quite vulnerable to manipulation, even very, very, very simple manipulation. So we were able to show in our paper that Facebook's, one of bad actors detection systems that Facebook uses, can be fooled 26% times by a very simple manipulation that a bad actor can do. And this is an in-deployment system that Facebook has, right? So this shows that these bots, these bad actors, these misinformation creators are able to change their behavior to manipulate the systems that are out there, that are there to detect and mitigate their impact.
Yeah, so I think so. One follow-up question to that is, like, one thing that you said is very interesting is these kind of bad actors are trying to improvise themselves based on these techniques that can filter them, right? So would you say that moving forward, as in from the AI community or like a research community perspective, adversarial training is one of the ways forward to train these kind of robust models that are robust? Like, I mean, I also wanted to, as in, define the robustness from you, for the audience who might not be able to understand what exactly we mean by robustness, but we'll come to that. But would you say adversarial training is like the only way forward, or like the most stable way forward to build these techniques that are prone to adversarial attacks?
The answer actually is, we don't know what is the best way to create systems that are not only accurate but also robust, right? I mean, there's no research in this topic, at least from the bad actor detection models that we are talking about. Right? There's a lot of research, for example, in the general area of adversarial robustness. And there, yes, adversarial training has been shown to be one of the ways that works well in creating models that are robust against certain types of adversarial attacks. But in the domains of misinformation detection, or in the domain, in the tasks of bad actor detection systems that are, let's say, graph-based or language-based or behavior-based, we actually don't know what is the best way to create systems that are accurate, that are robust without sacrificing the accuracy, right? So that's actually an open problem that needs to be solved.
And one more question that is like outside of this particular application domain, that is like combating misinformation, that I wanted to learn, like, because you have been working in this field for so long. So when, like, I always feel when people say building robust AI models versus like generalizable AI models, what are the differences? Are these terms like normally used interchangeably? Because what is the end product? Like when we say this is a robust AI model versus this is an AI model that can generalize to unseen test samples or unseen data sets,
what
is the key distinction between them? Or is it like a very overlapping definition?
Good question. Yeah, I think there's a fundamental, there's similarity, but also fundamental differences. So robustness, the generalizability is a subset of robustness. You gave an example of out-of-domain generalizability. So let me explain that. So let's say you train a model on certain type of data. Out-of-domain generalizability would be, will that model work well if the data distribution shifts, or if the data completely changes, or if the labels change, right? So there's concept drift and data drift and other changes that can happen in the data. How well the models would work around those? That was one. So that is around generalizability. So a big goal of AI community is to create models that are generalizable. And the reason is that you would want to create, you would want the model, you would, if you are able to create these generalizable models, then you are able to create some model and it will be able to work well in other unseen tasks or new tasks, right? So the system inherently becomes more reliable, more robust.
Right.
There are other types of robustness as well that one needs to care about. So I see robustness and reliability as a bigger umbrella, of which generalizability is one aspect. There are other aspects under the robustness umbrella. And the second is adversarial robustness. So the generalizability part, there's no bad actor who is trying to fool the system. It's just data shifts over time, or new data set is created and you want to apply it, right? So there's no malicious intent behind it. When you look at adversarial robustness, there's an adversary who's actively trying to break the system, right? So there's this arms race that we are dealing with. So adversarial robustness is this intentional attempt at breaking the system. So the robustness, so that's why robustness is a bigger umbrella term over that, also encapsulates generalizability and adversarial robustness.
Right. Yeah. This definition makes a lot more sense, as in like we don't have any bad actors that are trying to manipulate your predictions, versus in generalizability, it's like the inherent problem of the data. So it's like if I want to create like making models that are much more cognizant of the concepts in the data rather than just the style of data. So yeah,
yes,
that makes more sense. Yeah, I think the techniques to make robust AI models would be slightly different in that case, because we are trying inherently, I would say it would have some or the other way of adversarialness in the technique building of these kind of models, because we are trying to adapt model. Okay, makes sense.
And there's also this scenario where, you know, the even in the generalizability, the data, the concept, concepts might change over time as well, you know. That also happens. So all of this, in the generalizability, everything is happening naturally. And that's what you're trying to protect against.
Yeah. To add to this conversation, as in like one of the key things that we like also like we are working in my research is like we are working on trying to understand brain aging. So like normally it's a hypothesis that if you are older, like let's say you're suffering from Alzheimer's, you have like something that is called faster aging, like or like an accelerated aging. So your brain appears much more older than your actual biological age. So that is the way that we are trying to use deep learning models to detect these kind of aging patterns. But the key thing that normally like most of these algorithms fail is at, let's say you have a database that is collected by X university, like a institution, hospital. And if you have some other institute that is using slightly different scanner, the MRIs to you or like just me or you, it looks very similar. And even after there are so many sophisticated ways of post-processing these methods, registering so that these look perfectly good to the model. And when you take this model that is not like if I apply this model to a completely different country's hospital, let's say something in UK or China, or that has very, very different, the model fails drastically, like not even by like it doesn't fail by a small margin, it fails a lot. And it becomes like most of the problems, if you see in vision community, they typically work with, let's say, ImageNet dataset, CIFAR, and all those kind of works. The techniques have become so sophisticated that, yes, you can prove that these XYZ method that I claim tackles the problem of generalization. But when we come to real world scenarios where the data set have much more drifts, or I don't know what is the right word for that, but like distribution drifts in these kind of data sets.
Absolutely. I think that's a very real problem. So, you know, you can... You train data set, you train your model on data set A and it doesn't generalize to data set B because of various practical scenarios. You know, you use a different scanner, you use a different MRI machine, you use a different, you're at a different hospital that has a different way of recording the data and so on. All of that is very real. Yeah. And those are what we would call unintentional or natural, you know, shifts in data, natural changes in the data, and you would want models that are reliable, that are robust against those changes. Yes.
And let me switch gears and maybe ask you a different set of questions right now. So like we covered a lot of about you as a person who is working on combating misinformation online and making robust models using AI techniques. A student-friendly question is, like, we see, like, normally, like, you pretty much started your research journey at a very, like, I would still say it was a peak time of AI. But let's say if someone is starting right now, the field feels so much saturated or crowded that you have a plethora of things that a person can choose from. Like, I, as a person, I would feel interested in AI, but where do I start? I like large language models. I like vision transformers. I like ResNets. I like a lot of things. I like reinforcement learning. I love the idea of building something like a similar model to like AlphaGo, who is doing amazing predictions. What kind of advice would you give to a student who is interested in AI but is confused where it should be my starting point? How do we navigate to this crowded landscape of AI?
Yeah, it always feels crowded. I think, I mean, you are feeling, or you or your peers are feeling crowded. You're feeling that it's crowded now. When I started, I felt that it was already super crowded, right? So I think that feeling never goes away when you're starting starting your journey. So the thing is, just start somewhere, right? Like, don't overthink it. Find something that interests you and start with it, because it will always feel that it's super, it was easier back and now it's harder. I felt the same way when I started, right? So, as I said, I tried computer vision. I didn't enjoy it much because, you know, I don't know why. I think if I started computer vision now, I would enjoy it more, because now we have deep learning models. And when I started, you know, it was, I remember the project that I did was on like human pose estimation, and we had to get like these, there's no deep learning. People were not using deep learning back then when I was in my late high school and so on. So,
yeah.
You know, the fields change, fields evolve, because of these evolutions, new things emerge, which leads to which leads to advancements, but also leads to issues. So if you are starting as a researcher, as a junior PhD student, you can start, you can look at problems that you find interesting, but the best way is to find an area, broad area, not a problem, but a broad area that you might, that you think are interested in. Let's take a class in it. If you still find it interesting, you know, do a project in it with a professor who is working on it, and see if that interest continues to grow. Ideally, it should. Ideally, you should, as you learn more about something, you should find more, you should find it more and more interesting, and you know, get hands-on experience with it. Don't just read papers. Get hands-on experience, code, so that you know what you're getting into. And if all of these things work out, then you know then you have a starting point. Now the thing is, you these days the fields are getting so homogenized that the same techniques are being used across the fields, right? Yeah. So if you know how to use transformers, and let's say you were trained to use transformers in computer vision, with some effort you can learn to transfer that skill. You can use that skill and apply it in language. You can use that skill and apply it in graphs, right? It's not a direct transfer, but at least you are not starting from scratch, because the fields are getting more and more unified, which is a good thing, right? So what I see is that start somewhere that you find interesting, and find a project, find a topic that you want to explore. There are various different class projects that you can do, or you can explore various different things in class projects, for example, and just take it from there. You can do projects with faculty, you know, at Georgia Tech, for example, we have, you can do a special topics, essentially a project over a semester with the faculty. If you continue, if you like it, you can continue. If not, you know, you did a semester, you can move on to other things. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I completely agree. Like even though I'm a lesser experience in these domains than you, but definitely something, if someone would ask me, I would just say like, yeah, just start something, because it's practically impossible to like do a breadth first search on all the topics and then find something interesting. It's like the Sophie's choice thing, right? Like Sophie's choice, where you have like so many options and you are just eternally confused.
Yep.
So it's better to start from somewhere. And one of the key things I also like what you mentioned is like the fields being homogeneous, right? So when I started, like I'm working on 4 projects and all of them are medical imaging related. So I was concerned at some point, and I told my professor, I still want to be a PhD in computer science, not just like someone who is working on Alzheimer's and migraine detection. And she said the same thing, which you clarified, as in like, once you learn how to apply AI models on this particular data set, it is pretty much transferable under the assumption that you are able to transfer these knowledge. And most of people from my lab now work at Google, Tesla, Cruise, and even LinkedIn. So I think like pretty much lesser intersection of medical imaging in all of these companies. So yeah, that's a really factor for people like me to understand, that you can still be working on a particular topic as part of your master's or PhD, but you can still work.
Absolutely. I think when you're going, like if your goal is to get a job at an industry after, when I say you, I mean, not just you, but in general, student, if someone is interested in getting a position in AI machine learning, just do, you know, you don't need to work on the exact same problem in your dream company, because, you know, these companies have like hundreds of teams, if not thousands of teams within them. You typically interview for a general ML or data scientist or any of these positions, right? You're not applying for a particular team typically.
Right.
And they wouldn't test you on your specific skill set that you did in the project. But by doing projects, by doing research, by doing these the work, you get hands-on experience that you are able to learn these generalizable skills that you can apply and transfer. My students have also gone and worked at all the companies that you mentioned and more as well. And none of them, I can guarantee, are working on the same problems that they worked with me, right? So it's not about the exact problem that you're working on, but it's more about how you develop the skill set to learn these new technologies, right? Pretty much you will be learning, let's say, PyTorch or TensorFlow, right? Whichever framework, deep learning framework that you learn. You learn one, you are able to transfer it to the other one, and you are able to go beyond just that one project. So it's more about learning the skill set, learning the tools, learning the frameworks so that you are able to apply it broadly.
And talking about jobs, so one thing that we mentioned, like when you go for jobs in future, and increasingly nowadays, so typically, like if you see traditionally people who end up doing a PhD, typically like the rates of them becoming a professor or being in academia are slightly higher. But nowadays, like most of the times you can see people who are working in AI research, even in industry, they have like there is a higher tendency of people working in good research. Like there's good amount of research coming from companies that is leading the field ahead. And oftentimes it's like the majority of work comes from industry, good industry research labs. I want to understand, like, how would you characterize the significance of PhD, at least when we talk about computer science or specifically any broad domains of AI? What are the key things that you think PhD provides over working as other degrees in AI research roles? And you can, like, based on your experience, you can talk about being in academia, but I also prefer, like, if you have any insights being in industry, like, what does having a PhD give you an advantage over someone who does not have one?
Sure. Yeah, good question. I think that's a interesting thing to think about. I did spend some time at Google after Stanford and before Georgia Tech. So I do have some, I wouldn't claim a lot, but I do have some industry experience that I can contextualize my answer in. The skills, I would say that if you want to go into industry and do engineering work, data engineering, ML engineering, and so on, you don't need a PhD. But if you want to do fundamental research work, if you want to build algorithms, if you want to build, if you want to, you know, create new algorithms and so on, then you need a PhD, right? It's not just useful for you to get the position, but also to get promoted and go on in that career trajectory. It's not just about getting the position, right? Yeah. Of course, that being said, you can do a PhD and still do engineering work, data engineering, ML engineering work, or vice versa. You can be, let's say, a master's student and end up creating algorithms and so on, right? So it's not mutually exclusive. It doesn't guarantee, like, you can still do it. But yeah, more likely, if you have a PhD, you get the skill set of critical thinking about one problem or one type of problem and how you can deep dive into it. And how you are able to create solutions that are not straightforward or that do not exist. I think that is something that PhD teaches you, of creating solutions for things that don't exist. And typically in engineering, you know, you are building things on top of, you are building scalable systems on top of things that exist, right? So, which is also very challenging to do, right? Which is also very innovative, which is also very, very challenging, but the goals are different. One is about building things that can be used at large scale by many people, while when you're doing PhD, you're building pretty much proof of concepts. Yeah. That's the difference between what sort of skill set or what sort of expectations are from you after you are done from done after you have done PhD.
That's so true. I think even implementing these models as a part of my PhD, I think I've learned a lot more than most of these courses. I think there are more courses nowadays available online where they teach you how to build a model from scratch or like implement a model. But there are so many latent skills of just implementing just like a very basic version of ResNet and PyTorch that can teach you a lot. And most of the times when you do research, like you are implementing your own version of the idea, right? So that will make you go and like read more of the documentation of these tools and frameworks, and inherent process of doing those things will help you learn more about these framework and other skills that are, again, not a part of curriculum, as you said.
Exactly. And I think it's getting easier now with ChatGPT and GitHub Copilot and others being you, like, you can actually use that to enhance your learning and speed up your learning, right? You don't have to go and search for documentation, but rather you can use these tools to your own benefit, right? Many of these tools are fortunately free, but you know, in some cases you pay a minimal amount and you can get access to learn as well. So building something end to end definitely gives you the experience and expertise that you need to not just build that one thing, but the skill set. You develop the skill set to build something that is that goes beyond it.
True. And one additional point that I had was like, I'm not sure if you noticed the same thing about like the research community, as in like it's very like there is an inherent pressure in AI research community to publish more, because if you see the quantity of papers that are being published in the last 5 years, it's like higher than ever. And I normally tend to see like people publishing like crazy. Like if I follow a particular author, like there are some crazy amount of works being published every week, because I mean, partially it's because they have a huge lab. They are great, amazing works, but it's hard to keep up with these kind of works. Like the field constantly feels evolving. Like I still remember like when I started in 2020, there was this huge hype for vision transformers, right? So like they are saying that they are going to replace the standard convolution based neural network. And nowadays, I mean, I would say the graph is stabilizing. It's not like they are at par of convolutions. They are not outperforming and underperforming. So it's like these kind of things, like they, once in a while you'll see a paper that is doing a great thing, but then yeah, it's like the whole community shifts. So it's basically like the idea of following up on research is becoming harder, at least for someone like me who is just started dabbling in this field. So first of all, like my first question is like, do you feel the same? Like it's harder to catch up, or does it get better over time with your expertise and your filtering lenses of reading these articles? And secondly is, how does one who is new in his or her career escape the part of running down the rabbit holes of publishing more rather than focusing on some kind of quality work that has an impact, rather than just running experiments, having the GPU power, like you said, like the arms race for GPUs nowadays is also like a big thing. So publishing out results with just like a 0.01% increase in accuracy. So yeah, first question is, do you feel the same? And secondly, how do we avoid that?
So I always advise my students to go over quality over quantity. So because, you know, as a PhD student, your goal is not to publish many mediocre papers, but to publish few really great papers. Because as a PhD student, you know, you are doing fundamental research, right? Proof of concept research, which is what we do in academia, right? You're solving an important and interesting problem that the community and you care about, and you're trying to build solutions for that. What you're doing in terms of that is you want to find a so the problem definition, the problem itself is very important, right? You want to solve a problem that is that will have an impact if solved, right? Because you, let's say for each project you will be spending at least 6 months, let's say 1 month, 1 year, right? 6 months to a year you will be spending on one problem, right? So you do want to select a problem that will have impact, or that you and your advisor and your research team thinks that will have an impact. To do good work in 6 to 8 months or 10 months or 1 year, it takes time, right? It takes time to do that. And if you think PhD is 5 years, you know, and if you're working on, let's say, two projects in parallel, each of them take 1 year and there's some overlap and so on, so you can expect, like, you know, some a PhD student to publish anywhere between 4 to 8 papers, right, depending on how many projects they do in parallel, right? 4 to 8 papers during the course of their PhD, right? That's not a lot of papers, right? Which means you have to focus on quality over quantity, right? And as a student, you can't compare yourself with a professor who is running a group of, let's say, 10 PhD students, right? But it can feel overwhelming. I understand the emotion that you are going through of like just so much out there, right? And it keeps on coming. So I think one thing that one needs to do to try to overcome that is to see how is to understand that, you know, the problem of the field will evolve, the field will keep moving, but it won't move, it will stabilize, right? Yeah. In the sense, there are some times where certain topics get super hot and a lot of papers are published in a very short time period. And then after that, it gets stabilized, right? And typically that short period is a few months, right? It never is like several years. And after that happens, new papers that come out are making incremental progress on top of it. So when you're writing a paper which requires baselines, you are okay with comparing it with the original model that was there. And that means that while you can understand what the new research is that's coming out that uses the same base model but makes some improvement over it, you wouldn't necessarily need to compare it directly in your research paper when you are publishing it, right? It's okay for you to compare with the base model. Unless, of course, the new paper is doing exactly what you're doing and it's directly comparable. Typically, we have not seen reviewers complain if we don't. I mean, you know, the base models that we compare with have to be relevant. And we do compare with like more recent versions of that, but we cannot compare with every model that is out there, right? Mm-hmm. That's not even an expectation. So when we are doing rebuttals, for example, reviewers always ask for adding this baseline and that baseline. And we do add those, right? Because these are newer and these are more relevant. And when we are writing the paper as well, we do add the original base model and few extensions, few more recent versions of that. But I think it's important to understand the base fundamental models, the ones that have gotten a lot of attention and have changed, quote unquote, changed the field. And then after that, the new ones that are there, I think you can, you know, take those with a grain of salt.
Yeah. No, I love that. I think it's very important to filter out these kind of works when you read them, because it's like you said, like the quantity has increased, but it as I think you mature in your research, it becomes very important to filter out these problems and you see if this is just more like an incremental work versus some kind of genuine research. And yeah, that has to be done over time. And it comes after with some kind of experience of reviewing papers, reading papers, and understanding the problem set enough. So yeah. Thanks for sharing that. I think as I was saying, like, as in, like, normally I tend to keep the last question open to the speaker to ask more like general advice for people who are getting started in this field. But I think we covered a lot of advices, like where you said, like, you can just get started rather than overthinking about what are the options, what are the best ways for me to be interested in this field. But I'll still keep this question open.
So you asked any additional tips? Yeah. So I would say, you know, start with a goal in mind of what skill sets you want to develop. And enjoy the journey. So try a lot of things, see what works. I think in today's day and age, if you're looking for an industry position, it's very important to get the hands-on skill sets to on the tools, on the models, the tools, the frameworks that are out there. It's very important to get that understanding. And you can really get that. There's so many resources that are out there that are beyond the university scope, right? Like there's just so, like, compared to when I started, you can find so much information, so many great resources on GitHub, on Medium posts and so on, that you can really, if you do have the time and if you do have the passion for it, you know, you can really learn a lot of really amazing things.
I love that. But I'll put a pause on that particular. I won't add anything. I'll let you rush to your class. But thanks a lot for being here. It was an amazing conversation. I think people who are interested in this field will definitely enjoy that. I'll leave links to all your profiles and other things, so like if somebody's interested, they can reach out to you. But thanks once again for being on a short notice, and hope you have a good lecture.
Thank you, Jay. It was a pleasure. Thanks for having me. And if anyone wants to reach out to me, I'm very easy to find.
Yeah.
Awesome. All right. Thank you so much.